But joining me by phone this morning is Chris Orcutt. He's a professional writer based in Millbrook, New York. He has worked as an adjunct professor of literature and communications, a corporate communications consultant, and as a journalist, and he's received a New York Press Association Award. Chris Orcutt, good morning. Welcome to KGNU.
Good morning, Roger. Thank you for having me on your program.
Delighted to have you here. Chris, first, I'm not a writer, but your blog at Orcutt.net seems considerably unlike Ernest Hemingway, if I could say, in that you freely give away secrets about the writing craft to not only aspiring authors, but established writers as well. Why the openness about writing?
You know, that you're the first person to ever ask me that, and I mean in any interview, Roger. Hemingway was a masterful writer. I mean, he really was. But, you know, when you study his work and study what he left behind in terms of advice to young writers, it's all very cryptic. It's, you know, it's like the plot of an Indiana Jones movie trying to find his secrets. And that's something that's always annoyed me about him and his work, that he didn't leave behind, you know, more insight into craft. I guess it's just a response to that. You know, it's as I've made these discoveries, I think I'm at heart a teacher, and I just want to pass that on, you know, want to pass on. You know, Hemingway did say something really illuminating about writing. He said, "We are all apprentices in a craft where no one becomes a master." And I think that holds up. I think that's true. The thing about writing is you can always be better.
Excellent. Well, related to that, and at the heart of your most recent novel, A Truth Stranger Than Fiction, you describe a struggle between fossil fuels, interests/government, and the use of helium-3 as a viable energy alternative. Before we get into lunar mining and helium-3, can you tell us a bit about your Dakota Stevens mystery series, the three books you've written, a real piece of work, The Rich Are Different, and again, A Truth Stranger Than Fiction. Tell us about Dakota Stevens and that series.
Oh, thank you. Well, Dakota Stevens is a New York City or Manhattan-based PI, and I wrote him in the tradition of Chandler's Marlowe. Chandler, for listeners who don't know, Raymond Chandler created the quintessential PI named Philip Marlowe. And in my series, I have tried to imbue Dakota with a really interesting modern noir voice, where, you know, where men don't treat women as objects, where the women are intelligent, yes, beautiful, but intelligent, and, you know, contribute to the solving of a case. In many cases in my books, the women are the most intelligent, fearsome characters. But what I was going for with Dakota is to have that modern noir voice, and also to write novels that, you know, there are plenty of detective novels out there, Roger, you know, where it's just a detective and it's purely plot-driven. What I wanted to do was write novels about a detective, novels that can stand on their own, like Chandler's work does, where the plots are almost incidental, but, you know, you're compelled to read along because of the voice. And honestly, the quality of my writing is a cut above most of the stuff that's done in the mystery genre.
Okay. 8:37 is the time. My guest is Chris Orcutt. We're talking about not only his novels, but we're going to dig into the serious issue of helium-3 as an alternative energy source. We do invite callers to participate in the program. We might be able to squeeze in a call or two. Ava's waiting at the phones at 303-442-4242. Again, if you want to join the conversation or you have a question during this first half or the second half of Connections, give us a ring at 303-442-4242. Chris, before we get deeper into helium-3, kind of what I wanted to focus on this morning, I wanted your opinion as to why we should be concerned about an alternative energy source at this point in time, considering that we seem to be awash in oil and natural gas, Chris?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, Roger. You know, the discovery of or being able the fossil fuel companies being able to derive a lot of energy out of the Bakken Formation in North Dakota and Montana, where they're using the process of fracking to extract oil and natural gas. They've recently revealed that that oil deposit is potentially larger than all of Saudi Arabia and all of the oil deposits in the Middle East. I mean, it's thought to be that big. So it's a good question. You know, if we're awash in oil in these resources, why should we be looking for an alternative? Well, the writing is on the wall in terms of how greenhouse gases are contributing to climate change. And helium-3, I can describe the process in a little more detail in a minute, but helium-3 produces profound energy with no greenhouse gas emissions and no radioactive waste. And that's the reason why we need to go in this new direction. Yeah, let's start the research now. Let's start the development now, not for right now, but 20, 25 years from now, before we take the last drop of oil or the, you know, the last gasp of natural gas out of the earth.
Okay, well, let's take this opportunity to talk about helium-3 a little bit more in depth. To be honest with you, in a public display of ignorance, I'd never heard of helium-3 until I was contacted by your publicist, and I appreciate his patience. I've since then, of course, learned a little bit more about it. But how is it different than regular old helium?
Right.
And what makes it so valuable as an energy source in that regard? I guess compare and contrast old helium with helium-3.
Well, old helium, which is known in chemistry as common helium, is the gas that we put into balloons to make them float and, you know, that we breathe in to make our voices sound funny, like Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz. And helium-3 is different because helium-3 is missing one neutron. It's called an isotope of common helium. And this missing neutron enables it to be combined with other helium-3 molecules in a nuclear process, nuclear fusion. What we have on Earth and what we use today is nuclear fission, where we're splitting uranium or plutonium. Okay, fission, splitting matter, releasing energy. Fusion is the process used by our sun to produce energy. Fusion produces a profoundly more energy than fission does. And in this case, when you join two helium-3 molecules, not only is the energy produced profound, just to give your listeners an idea, one ton of helium-3 is the equivalent of 50 million barrels of crude oil. And 25 tons of the stuff would provide enough energy for the entire United States for a year. So it's incredibly powerful. And again, there's no resulting radioactive waste at the end of the process, and there are no greenhouse gas emissions like carbon dioxide.
I know maybe two decades ago or so there was a lot of talk about cold fusion, but I guess in this regard you're talking about hot fusion, if I can label it as such. Are there any active or working fusion reactors at this time that could handle helium-3 or anything like that?
Well, first I want to preface, you know, your listeners clearly understand by now that I am not a scientist. I'm a novelist. However, you know, everything that I've put into A True Stranger Than Fiction as regards the mystery and alternative energy is based on research, and I've been doing research about this for about 7 years. About 7 years of research went into this, and there is this is not a science fiction concept. This has been done and can be done. The University of Wisconsin-Madison has a fusion technology institute, and they have successfully fused helium-3 molecules in a reaction, proving that it can be done. Now, that being said, we do not have commercial scale fusion reactors on Earth today. This would be part of the investment. This is part of the future investment that, you know, governments and corporations will need to make in order to make this a viable, you know, alternative. One of the things about helium-3 that's really intriguing, Roger, is that, you know, the scientists, it's a far more efficient means of gaining energy, because in our typical production of electricity, what happens is this. We burn coal or oil to create steam from water, and that steam and the steam pressure turns turbines, which then produce electricity. In a helium-3 reaction, what would happen is in the fusion of the helium-3, a state of matter is created called plasma. And these ions in the plasma would be converted directly to electricity without those intervening processes like, you know, steam conversion. And the point about that is it's much more efficient. Helium-3, electricity from helium-3 is projected to be almost twice as efficient as what we currently have.
So you mentioned this direct conversion into plasma, but maybe we could take a step back, and not to delve too much into the physics of all of it or the history of it, but fission, which we have apparently plenty of around the planet, like oil and gas, relies basically on boiling water. Is that correct?
Yes, that, you know, that at its heart is it's what it's doing is it's producing energy to create steam, and that steam is used to create electricity by powering turbines.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about helium-3 itself. You mentioned this on your blog, of course, in your writing, and it's all over the internet, as I have found. Why not just scoop up some helium-3 or manufacture it here on Earth? Why not a plentiful
supply? Great question.
Yeah.
I mean, great question. The thing is, Roger, that helium-3 is produced by our sun as a waste product of its fusion. The problem is, on Earth, our magnetic field repels it. So our magnetic field has been repelling this stuff that's been emitted by the sun for billions of years, but it's ended up on the moon's surface, and it's been embedded in the regolith, or the soil of the moon. And it's projected by lunar scientists that there is enough helium-3 embedded in the soil, wait for this, to power the entire Earth for 10,000 years.
And apparently this is not science fiction. The Apollo astronauts apparently took some samples that indicate that these figures are accurate.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing, you know, this is the thing that set me down the road in my mystery, in A True Stranger Than Fiction, of corporate government collusion and, you know, government secrets, because our government has known about the existence of helium-3 going, as you just said, going all the way back to the Apollo missions. And it begs the question of why haven't we been actively researching this. I'm not talking about tomorrow dumping fossil fuels and going to helium-3. We couldn't do that if we wanted to. I'm talking about taking those initial steps. You know, why we weren't doing this in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I don't understand, especially when we had the oil crisis in the 70s.
But even pushing helium-3 aside for the moment, why haven't we been pursuing commercial-grade or usable fusion reactors at this point? You mentioned earlier there's maybe an experimental model at a university, but why aren't we looking into fusion more closely? And not only us, Europe, Russians, China, whoever.
Well, one thing is there are other countries around the world are onto this. Of China right now, or as of the tail end of last month and beginning of this month, had a probe circling the moon. It was scheduled to retrieve rock and soil samples, bring them back to Earth, and they're scheduled to return to the moon, possibly with a manned mission by 2020. China also has one of the world's premier helium-3 fusion scientists working for them. And, you know, so there, China is one government that is looking into this. But there, this is, I think, going to be a grassroots corporate movement. There are corporations investing in this technology. One company in the Silicon Valley, titled Moon Express, named Moon Express, has as their president Andrew Aldrin, Buzz Aldrin's son. Buzz Aldrin, of course, was the second man on the moon. And so they are very serious about going to the moon and having robots extract helium-3 and also rare earth metals that, you know, are rare here on Earth and needed in the electronics industry. So there's one corporation here in the United States that's doing looking into lunar mining. But there is also this the spacecraft or, you know, aerospace giant Lockheed Martin. They are developing what they're calling a compact fusion reactor. Now, their fusion model wouldn't be powered by helium-3. It would be powered on by basically what's known as heavy hydrogen or isotopes of hydrogen, which is much more common here on Earth. Their whole model is to produce what they call a compact fusion reactor, Roger, that could fit into the back of a person's pickup truck, and that would produce enough power for 80,000 people. So there, you know, there are these companies and governments actively researching this, taking active steps toward development. But you don't see this, you know, you're not going to see this in the common media. I was first turned on to the idea of helium-3 and lunar mining back in 2007. I saw a documentary. And right around that time, then-President George Bush said, we're going to go back to the moon. The implication was, we're going to go back up to the moon because of helium-3. You know, I looked into it, and I was like, why are they going to do this? And I saw this correlation. Well, fast forward to 2010, when they started pulling vast amounts of oil and natural gas out of the Bakken formation, and all talk in the mainstream media about helium-3 and virtually all talk about alternative energies in general ceased.
Certainly. So there's obviously this interest or this waning interest at the moment in helium-3 on the part of government and maybe industries, with the exception of the corporation you mentioned and the Chinese. But how economically practical would it be mining the moon? Do we, the Chinese, the Russians, any of these corporations really have the ability to bring back large enough quantities of anything to make it worth our while? Maybe you can talk about the mechanics of it and the economics of it. Going to the moon, mining helium-3 or anything else for that matter, and actually getting it back to planet Earth.
It is seemingly a daunting task. But, you know, everything that is possible today, Roger, was once considered impossible. If you, 100 years ago, had said, well, we're going to send people to the moon, we're going to send men to the moon, and they'll land on the moon and stand on the moon and bring back rock and soil samples from the moon, people would have laughed at you. They would have thought you were crazy, that we didn't have that ability. 100 years ago, people were still getting around, in large part, by horse and buggy. So, you know, everything that is possible today was once considered impossible. We are the only country on Earth, the United States, to have done a manned mission to the moon. We also have proven ourselves here on Earth to be very good at getting resources out of the ground. One model that I've seen as far as the mechanics of this would go, and I think to some extent this was kind of a diagram I saw in Newsweek, and the concept was that there would be these robots that were basically giant vacuums that would vacuum up the moon soil, and in vacuuming up the soil, inside the robot, these would have to be very, very large. It would raise the temperature of that soil to, I believe, 700 degrees Celsius. And you need to get it to that temperature to release the helium-3. And then the helium-3 would be, I guess, you know, distilled in a kind of a distillation process and then compressed in gas form into canisters. Now, the one thing I will say that, you know, makes this a pretty daunting task, but I think it can be overcome. I mean, if 150 years ago, when people saw oil coming out of the ground, you know, very few people saw the possibility in it. You know, and for example, gasoline only came about because J.D. Rockefeller said, "What are we going to do with this waste product?" Gasoline was considered just this unstable waste product, but then the development of the internal combustion engine enabled them to use this waste product as something practical and has had great value for 100 years now. But the thing is, on the moon, what we're looking at is, it is kind of a daunting picture, because helium-3, although in great abundance on the moon, it's apparently a very low density. So it would require the mining of vast amounts of moon soil to produce a ton of helium-3. Now, these figures, you know, these are estimates, but one estimate that I read is that we would need to process 150 million tons of moon soil to produce 1 ton of helium-3. So it's 150 million to 1 ratio. Which is, you know, it's very, even on the moon where it's there in great quantity, it's still not densely, it's still not dense in the soil. So that is something that, you know, it's a little daunting, but I have confidence that if humanity made this a priority, we would develop the technologies to solve the problem.
Certainly daunting and, you know, huge numbers, to say the least. In 2007, a Russian submarine planted their national flag on the sea bottom at the North Pole. A little bit later, Russian President Vladimir Putin reassured the world that the gesture was purely symbolic, referencing the American flag on the moon's surface as an example. Nevertheless, could the future hold competing mining claims or even claims of sovereignty on the moon? Who owns the moon?
Absolutely. Who owns the moon? Great question. If you go online, there are any number of websites out there where you can, you know, a common citizen, you can purchase, quote-unquote, a piece of real estate on the moon. You know, but do they have the right to sell this? They haven't been there. The philosopher John Locke talked about, you know, that basically you need to work the thing in order for it to be owned. Once you apply your labor to a thing, then, you know, that constitutes ownership. So it does raise an interesting question of, you know, who owns it. I think the thing is, the history of the world, unfortunately, has been one of whoever takes it owns it, you know, and unfortunately, it's often the society or the country with the biggest guns and the most guns. You know, that's what colonialism was all about. You know, the countries like Britain, like the United States, like Europe, going into Africa, they had the more advanced technology, they had the guns, they took ownership of the property, they use the resources. But the thing is, this, Roger, is on such a scale, I don't think, and what I've read, other experts talking about the same thing have said, they seem to universally agree that this could not be done by one government or one corporation alone. This is going to have to be a multi-government, multi-corporate effort. And so it's going to require skills and cooperation instead of competition. You know, so it begs the question of, you know, we're predicating the idea of doing this based on the old model of competing interests. And I think this is one where we're going to have to cooperate.
Fortunately, Chris, we are completely out of time. Is there a way we can learn more about your writing, your work,
Absolutely.
Dakota Stevens, and all that interesting stuff?
Sure. My website is Orcutt, O-R-C-U-T-T, as in Thomas, .net.
Okay, Chris, well, thank you very much for your appearance on KGNU this morning.
Thank you, Roger. It was a pleasure.
Great. My guest has been Chris Orcutt, and he's author of a number of fiction books based on the Dakota Stevens mystery series. Almost twice as efficient as what we currently have. So you mentioned this direct conversion into plasma, but maybe we could take a step back and not to dwell too much into the physics of all of it or the history of it, but fission, which we have apparently plenty of around the planet, like oil and gas, relies basically on boiling water. Is that correct?
Yes, that, you know, that at its heart is... It's what it's doing is it's producing energy to create create steam, and that steam is used to create electricity by powering turbines.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about helium-3 itself. You mentioned this on your blog, of course, in your writing, and it's all over the internet, as I have found. Why not just scoop up some helium-3 or manufacture it here on Earth? Why not a plentiful
supply? Great question.
Yeah.
I mean, great question. The thing is, Roger, that helium-3 is produced by our sun as a waste product of its fusion. The problem is, on Earth, our magnetic field repels it. So our magnetic field has been repelling this stuff that's been emitted by the sun for billions of years, but it's ended up on the moon's surface. And it's been embedded in the regolith, or the soil of the moon. And it's projected by lunar scientists that there is enough helium-3 embedded in the soil, wait for this, to power the entire Earth for 10,000 years.
And apparently this is not science fiction. The Apollo astronauts apparently took some samples that indicate that these figures are accurate.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing, you know, this is the thing that set me down the road in my mystery, in A True Stranger Than Fiction, of corporate government collusion and, you know, government secrets. Because our government has known about the existence of helium-3 going, as you just said, going all the way back to the Apollo missions. And it begs the question of why haven't we been actively researching this? I'm not talking about tomorrow dumping fossil fuels and going to helium-3. We couldn't do that if we wanted to. I'm talking about taking those initial steps. You know, why we weren't doing this in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I don't understand, especially when we had the oil crisis in the 70s.
But even pushing helium-3 aside for the moment, why haven't we been pursuing commercial-grade or usable fusion reactors at this point? You mentioned earlier there's maybe an experimental model at a university, but why aren't we looking into fusion more closely? And not only us, Europe, Russians, China, whoever.
Well, one thing is there are other countries around the world are onto this. Of China right now, or as of the tail end of last month and beginning of this month, had a probe circling the moon. It was scheduled to retrieve rock and soil samples, bring them back to Earth, and they're scheduled to return to the moon, possibly with a manned mission by 2020. China also has one of the world's premier helium-3 fusion scientists working for them. And, you know, so there, China is one government that is looking into this. But this is, I think, going to be a grassroots corporate movement. There are corporations investing in this technology. One company in the Silicon Valley, titled Moon Express, has as their president Andrew Aldrin, Buzz Aldrin's son. Buzz Aldrin, of course, was the second man on the moon. And so they are very serious about going to the moon and having robots extract helium-3 and also rare earth metals that, you know, are rare here on Earth and needed in the electronics industry. So there's one corporation here in the United States that's looking into lunar mining. But there is also the spacecraft or, you know, aerospace giant Lockheed Martin. They are developing what they're calling a compact fusion reactor. Now, their fusion model wouldn't be powered by helium-3. It would be powered on by basically what's known as heavy hydrogen or isotopes of hydrogen, which is much more common here on Earth. Their whole model is to produce what they call a compact fusion reactor, Roger, that could fit into the back of a person's pickup truck, and that would produce enough power for 80,000 people. So there are these companies and governments actively researching this, taking active steps toward development. But you don't see this, you know, you're not going to see this in the common media. I was first turned on to the idea of helium-3 and lunar mining back in 2007. I saw a documentary. And right around that time, then-President George Bush said, we're going to go back to the moon. The implication was, we're going to go back up to the moon because of helium-3. You know, I looked into it, and I was like, why are they going to do this? And I saw this correlation. Well, fast forward to 2010, when they started pulling vast amounts of oil and natural gas out of the Bakken formation, and all talk in the mainstream media about helium-3 and virtually all talk about alternative energies in general ceased.
Certainly. So there's obviously this interest or this waning interest at the moment in helium-3 on the part of government and maybe industries, with the exception of the corporation you mentioned and the Chinese. But how economically practical would it be mining the moon? Do we, the Chinese, the Russians, any of these corporations really have the ability to bring back large enough quantities of anything to make it worth our while? Maybe you can talk about the mechanics of it and the economics of it. Going to the moon, mining helium-3 or anything else for that matter, and actually getting it back to planet Earth.
It is seemingly a daunting task. But, you know, everything that is possible today, Roger, was once considered impossible. If you 100 years ago had said, well, we're going to send people to the moon, we're going to send men to the moon, and they'll land on the moon and stand on the moon and bring back rock and soil samples from the moon, people would have laughed at you. They would have thought you were crazy, that we didn't have that ability. 100 years ago, people were still getting around in large part by horse and buggy. So, you know, everything that is possible today was once considered impossible. We are the only country on Earth, the United States, to have done a manned mission to the moon. We also have proven ourselves here on Earth to be very good at getting resources out of the ground. One model that I've seen as far as the mechanics of this would go, and I think to some extent this was kind of a this was a diagram I saw in Newsweek, and the concept was that there would be these robots that were basically giant vacuums that would vacuum up the moon soil, and in vacuuming up the soil, inside the robot, these would have to be very, very large. It would raise the temperature of that soil to, I believe, 700 degrees Celsius. And you need to get it to that temperature to release the helium-3. And then the helium-3 would be, I guess, you know, distilled in a kind of a distillation process, and then compressed in gas form into canisters. Now, the one thing I will say that, you know, makes this a pretty daunting task, but I think it can be overcome. I mean, if 150 years ago, when people saw oil coming out of the ground, you know, very few people saw the possibility in it. You know, and for example, gasoline only came about because J.D. Rockefeller said, what are we going to do with this waste product? Gasoline was considered just this unstable waste product. But then the development of the internal combustion engine enabled them to use this waste product as something practical and has had great value for 100 years now. But the thing is, on the moon, what we're looking at is, it is kind of a daunting picture, because helium-3, although in great abundance on the moon, it's apparently a very low density. So it would require the mining of vast amounts of moon soil to produce a ton of helium-3. Now, these figures, you know, these are estimates, but one estimate that I read is that we would need to process 150 million tons of moon soil to produce 1 ton of helium-3. So it's 150 million to 1 ratio, which is, you know, it's very, even on the moon where it's there in great quantity, it's still not densely, it's still not dense in the soil. So that is something that, you know, it's a little daunting, but I have confidence that if humanity made this a priority, we would develop the technologies to solve the problem.
Certainly daunting and, you know, huge numbers to say the least. In 2007, a Russian submarine planted their national flag on the sea bottom at the North Pole. A little bit later, Russian President Vladimir Putin reassured the world that the gesture was purely symbolic, referencing the American flag on the moon's surface as an example. Nevertheless, could the future hold competing mining claims or even claims of sovereignty on the moon? Who owns the moon?
Absolutely. Who owns the moon? Great question. If you go online, there are any number of websites out there where you can, you know, common citizen, you can purchase, quote unquote, a piece of real estate on the moon. You know, but do they have the right to sell this? They haven't been there. You know, the philosopher John Locke talked about, you know, that basically you need to work the thing in order for it to be owned. Once you apply your labor to a thing, then, you know, that constitutes ownership. So, you know, it does raise an interesting question of, you know, who owns it. I think the thing is, the history of the world, unfortunately, has been one of whoever takes it owns it, you know, and unfortunately, it's often the society or the country with the biggest guns and the most guns, you know, that's what colonialism was all about. You know, the countries like Britain, like the United States, like Europe, going into Africa, they had the more advanced technology. They had the guns. They took ownership of the property. They used the resources. But the thing is, this, Roger, is on such a scale. I don't think, and what I've read, other experts talking about the same thing have said, they seem to universally agree that this could not be done by one government or one corporation alone. This is going to have to be a multi-government, multi-corporate effort. And so it's going to require skills and cooperation instead of competition. You know, so it begs the question of, you know, we're predicating the idea of doing this based on the old model of competing interests. And I think this is one where we're going to have to cooperate.
We don't have a lot of time left together, but sadly, I wanted to remind, I guess, all of us of what Amy Goodman kind of addressed this morning, and that is ISIS defaced a lot of artifacts in Iraq, apparently, this month, ancient artifacts. And I know it's a bit of a stretch, but I'm wondering, regardless of who thinks they own the moon, is there any kind of protocol or agreement about defacing something like a comet or mining or scraping the surface of the moon? Anything in regards to that?
I know nothing of that. I can think of no example when you mentioned the defacing of artifacts in Iraq, it made me think of the Shelley poem, Ozymandias. I am Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair. It's a poem about a traveler through an antique land, and he sees the ruins of this former great society, this king Ozymandias, who was long since dead.